welcome to another episode of Interactive Control, the place to get all your burning industrial control questions answered. I'm your host, Michelle Rosinski. Today I'll continue to talk about DCS ownership and lifecycle considerations with my guest, Paul Ricks. Paul is a retired specialist in the field of industrial process automation. During his 30-plus years in this field, he's worked in international management roles for national and international companies, covering all aspects of the INC business. Most recently, he specialized in global account and product management, and has held a variety of senior roles involving extensive global travel and long-term postings in the Middle East and Asia. Academically, he holds a UK bachelor's and master's degrees in physics and engineering, respectively, and is both a European registered professional engineer and a UK chartered engineer. We had so much to cover with this topic that we split it into two sessions. This session is part two, and we get into the details of tendering, negotiations, contract management, engineering and commissioning, and aftermarket lifecycle support. You don't want to miss the end, where Paul goes through each one of the phases and shares his thoughts on best practices. And don't forget to check out part one if you missed it. Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Good evening, Michelle.
So just to recap where we were last week, you talked about your background, how it related to our topic of DCS ownership and lifecycle considerations. You talked about the importance of the relationship between the DCS owner and the DCS vendor. And then we went through and you listed out the main components as you saw them of the DCS lifecycle, which included vendor selection, spec creation, tendering process, negotiations, contract management, engineering, commissioning, service lifecycle support, expansion, enhancement, and decommissioning. And then you were going through each of those to talk about some of the things you've seen in the past, good examples, bad examples, and, you know, give your take on how that all went through. And so you got through vendor creation and spec creation last time. So we're going to start off with the tendering process.
Very good. And again, I think I just start to just to add to what you've just said there, Michelle, with the understanding we're still very early in the process. And this is something that different people in the whole life cycle often don't see or think about. But here is where a large part of the relationship can be created or destroyed. And I've seen both happen across the years. So as we go into tendering, and you asked me a question last time, what do you sort of mean by tendering? Tendering to me now is the process. The specs are put together. A vendor list has been created somehow. And now the inquiries are going out to the DCS companies with the request to put together some kind of estimate, proposal, quotation, as you will. And the different types of tendering I've seen across the years, the first, and I think the one I would have to say is probably the most common, is a document which quite clearly says, we want the lowest price. That's it. Anything we can possibly do to get the lowest price, that's what's going to make you win or lose. And I would just add that in my experience, I don't think I have ever seen an example of where taking that lowest price has ever resulted in the best value of the life cycle. This to me is absolutely critical. In some countries around the world, in some areas around the world, it's actually legal that you have to go through this tendering. Most people put in their tenders something along the lines of, you know, we're not obliged to accept the lowest price, but invariably this is what it seems to come down to. And I think, Michelle, the critical point here is, again, the people that are involved at this stage tend to be fleeting visitors to the process. They're procurement people, maybe. They're an EPC. They're people that aren't going to live through the full 25, 30, whatever years of this product and its relationship with the end user. And so doing something, let me use the word cheap here, can lead to real problems later on down the line. And in my opinion, very often does. You know, you have two businesses discussing at this point. There's an end user who wants, obviously, a low price. There's a DCS vendor who needs to make a profit. And if this becomes too complex and too aggressive, then these two end up in an adversarial situation. Maybe they don't even see it, but it's becoming adversarial at this point. The DCS vendors have all sorts of tricks to make the lowest price happen, but you bet that's not how it's going to end up after 25 years. So I do urge some caution, and I would really, any of our listeners out there that are in the position of looking for a DCS vendor, is be very careful about just blindly pursuing the lowest initial cost approach. I don't think it works very far. The most extreme example I've seen of this was in Syria, with a petroleum company in Syria, where we actually had, I don't know if this translates into US English or not, Michelle, what we call a Dutch auction, where the bidders were online and just gradually undercutting each other until they all fell out and there was only one left in the thing with the lowest price.
That sounds like a terrible approach. It just, people cut things out, right? So then as you're trying to get the lowest price,
absolutely,
the vendor is cutting out as much as they can to be competitive, but that's not going to give you the best solution.
That's right. And every time you cut, every time the vendor takes a cut of that, the profits go in. And, you know, we have to accept the vendors are in there to make some kind of profit. It should be a reasonable, a fair profit, but they are. And every time that number comes down and down and down and down and down, you also lose a little bit of the ability to be relational rather than adversarial throughout the contract. I really struggled with that one a lot throughout my career. The other side is to go to some kind of single vendor situation. And I've also seen this. And I would have to say, some cases, it works extremely well. There is a very large US chemical company, a very large international US chemical company, who had predefined through some benchmarking exercises and assessments of vendors, two DCS companies. That's all they would ever use, two. Every project they did, wherever it was in the world, whoever the EPC contractor was, they would make a decision very early on in the project. We are going to give this to DCS vendor A or DCS vendor B, and that was it. At that point, the decision was made. That vendor was going to get the job, but now they were going to work with the company in a constructive, relational way from very early on in the process, to create best value rather than just lowest price. And just my feeling is that in most instances, best value actually turned out to be lowest life cycle cost. It was absolutely fascinating to watch it. Another chemical company up in the New York area as well, who were international, they went even one step further. They had just a single vendor. They had a totally single vendor relationship, not even a dual vendor. One vendor, and that vendor was going to work on all projects they built anywhere around the world, obviously to some sort of agreed framework agreement. And what I saw time and time again was the relationships were infinitely better. In fact, with those two examples, and there were more of them, I don't think I ever saw the relationship sour at all throughout the life cycles of those projects. And in Norway, these guys, the Norwegians, did this. It was amazing to watch, Michelle. What was then Statoil, the national oil company in Norway, they worked with a couple of DCS vendors. But they even took that one step further to the EPC. I worked on a project, Caster, a very large gas gathering station up in Norway. handled something like 7% of the whole of Europe's onshore gas coming in from the North Sea. And they actually brought that down. They did it with the EPC contractors as well. They just had two EPC contractors in a design race. They didn't even have them quoting. They just had them, they paid them to produce designs. Then they selected the best design, and that was just taken, and away the company went. But those companies in turn then involved the DCS vendors. And I spent quite a nice evening in London with one of these EPC contractors, and there were some 100-150 of the nominated sub vendors were all together helping that EPC contractor put together its most efficient EPC design to Statoil. It was fantastic. And what Statoil knew, they proved it to themselves time and time again, was the earlier main equipment suppliers are involved in the project, the better the value. People have ideas early, it gets done early, and they just eliminate the tendering phase. They just eliminate that whole thing. It's all done to a frame agreement. Whatever the design finally is, the prices are all catalogued, listed, and agreed up front. It was phenomenal. It was a great pleasure to work in it. And to come on, to take that one a step further then, the other question I would ask, and I guess if we, our listeners, DCS owners, probably say, why would you do this? The next question is, would you adopt a fixed price or a time and materials costing mechanism for a project? And I guess the natural reaction for most people, most customers, is to say fixed price. You know, we can't afford to fixed price all the way, fixed price. And yet the example I talked about of the US chemical company, they required their DCS vendor, the two DCS vendors, whichever one was doing a project with them, they had to give two prices, a fixed price and basically a budget estimate based on that it would then be conducted on a time and materials basis. And this company, most times, more times than not, always chose to take the DCS on a time and material basis. And that stunned me. The first time I saw this done, I thought, wow, that's incredible. What's the rationale for it? And in chatting to some of the guys there, they said, well, very simple. If the DCS vendor gives us a fixed price, number one, they will put a risk provision and contingency into their price. If we conduct our business on a time and material basis, that can immediately be taken out. It's not there anymore because they know we're going to treat them fairly, but the prices are already included in a frame agreement. So it really is a sort of book and invoice type situation. And most of the projects they did were based on that mechanism, and they were superb projects. They really, every one of them that I ever saw and was involved in went extremely, extremely well.
Okay.
Yeah, that to me, again, you know, we companies that run lots of DCS, companies that run small DCS, but the points here reflect are relevant to both. It's choosing how you really begin the relationship and how you work together, even at this very early stage, before, quite frankly, the anybody's even started engineering, let alone the actual life cycle of the thing itself.
So what's the difference between tendering and negotiations? I know last time you said, well, you could consider them potentially the same, but...
Yes. I like to separate these two because the tendering process, in a very traditional sense, would normally follow this sort of lowest cost principle. They get to a point where typically, from my experience, they would have said, okay, this vendor is the lowest cost. And in backup, we have another guy here, maybe two, just in case things go wrong. Then you get into a negotiation. And it always happens, however subtly or unsubtly, this always goes on. And basically, this is effectively where the procurement department comes out. the DCS vendor gets their most aggressive salesman out, and they sit there and quite frankly just try and draw blood. And it's again, it's another step, but a distinct step, in just potentially creating an adverse relationship. The more and more and more this is going on throughout these early stages, the more it's almost certain somebody, both parties, but normally the DCS vendor, I have to say, is going to try to recover what they've lost at this stage later on in the project. And because a certain amount of the relationship probably hasn't even really been properly created, that's going to be more aggressive than it would have done otherwise. And if you're not very careful, the whole thing really does start to fall apart. And for me, the concept of that negotiation phase, I saw only once have I ever seen this, but after the customer basically told us, yes, you will get the order, you have the DCS, you've satisfied whatever criteria we wanted to for us to choose you, then they said, now what we want to do now, you can put the specs away, that's all been done and finished with that. Now we want to sit in a room together, your engineering team, our engineering team, your project management team, our project, and we want to sit together. And now for a day, it was 2 days, the one I sat through, we just want to do a value engineering session. We now want to just sit there and said, okay, how can we now, when we go into this, introduce good ideas, remove things that maybe aren't necessarily going to be required, and generally together sit and look at how we can make this thing better from a value perspective rather than just a sheer cost perspective at this stage in the session.
I love that. That's a way to try to talk about. So you do your spec, you get your kind of base functionality nailed down, and you choose your vendor. But then you talk to your vendor about the possibilities and how you can get more value out of it.
Absolutely. Now, what can we do before we start delivering what we've all just sat here and agreed? You know, let's just take a look. Let's just take a few minutes, take a look. What can we do better? And it was absolutely amazing. The downside of that is I can remember trying it on an EPC down in the Emirates for a project down in Sudan, and I went into the procurement manager's office and said to him, look, you know, in this particular case, you have no option. You have to use us because we're the existing vendor at the site anyway. So that it's going to be an extension to the existing system. But why don't we sit here? Look, I can suggest to you here and now, sitting here and now, a way to reduce the cost, the price of this system by a very considerable amount, and I'm talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the reaction from the procurement people was, yeah, but then does it meet our specification? I said, no, it doesn't. But functionally, it's going to do it even what the customer wants even better. So together, we could go to the end user and say, hey, look, same technology, it's the core technology you already have on the plant, but we think that together, if we do it this way and incorporate this, we can save several hundred thousand dollars from the cost. And the EPC contractor said, no, finish. No, I don't want to talk about it. That's it. We have a specification. Specification's agreed. I'm not doing it. End of story. And it's the one and only time in my career, in the whole of my 30-odd years, I've been thrown out of a customer. That EPC threw me out of the office.
Could you talk at all about, you know, what was the difference? Like, what was the recommendation you were making that would have saved money?
Absolutely. It was built-in barriers, IS barriers, into the IO cards. The specification, which actually was remember what we talked about earlier, Michelle, about these specifications and how they can become totally aged and inflexible. This was
right.
One example. The EPC had a specification which said, you will use external barriers, IS barriers. Finish. That's it. And we said, well, look, with the solution we have, we don't need those because we have an IO card that's got the barriers integrated. And that's what it was about. And it would literally have taken all the external barriers out with a something like a 4-5% increase in the IO card cost. But of course, you take all the barrier costs out and all the wiring and the and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they wouldn't even entertain it. They wouldn't even entertain the discussion. This is our specification. That's the way we do it. That's the end of it. That's it. And in the end, the discussion got a little heated. I was thrown out, and he didn't talk to me again until the following week when he needed a small favour done, and then we made up again. but that's it, Michelle. And again, this is what I mean by the relationship between all of the parties that are involved here. There are occasions where being constructive and working together in a really good way and establishing that relationship can be good for everybody. And that I prefer to see rather than just, right, sit down, how much discount are you going to give us? And that tends to be the more common of the meetings at this stage.
So is that getting into the contract management piece of it then?
Yes, I think so, absolutely. And you again commented, I think, a little bit earlier on, the difference between project management and contract management. And I always think of project management as being very much as a sort of almost a kind of technical process of managing the project. Contract management, this is something a little different. And if by now the relationship has not been created and is not on the right footing to begin, there is often a very good chance that it's going to go wrong here. And by contract management, I mean the commercial management of the contract. I worked for a company at one point who had a very bad reputation for this type of thing. That same company was the company that also had the relationship with that US chemical company where it was all done by frame agreement and pre-agreement, et cetera, et cetera. So I saw in just one DCS vendor two entirely different persona. When they worked together very tightly in a good relationship and a good structure with a customer, it went really well and they were incredibly good and the whole thing just went very nicely. If they'd ever got into a situation where they'd been driven lower on price to take a contract, then all of a sudden things could go wrong in this stage, because these guys will come out and now start to issue contract variations. And it would amaze you how many different ways contract variations can come up. The end user didn't have something on site ready to receive something from the DCS part. It's delayed. We've had to pull back all our engineers. Here's a variation order. Something else has changed. Here's another variation order. And this is what the thing I'm talking about, Michelle. If the relationship up till this stage has not been is not a good one, then at this point in the contract management, it can really start to get extremely unpleasant. And in one case, for a couple of combined cycle gas turbine projects in the UK, it actually ended out that the DCS vendor went to site and locked the systems, so that the end user couldn't actually operate the plants and walk away and say, until you've paid the bills, we're not unlocking it and you can't create power to go onto the grid. The whole thing ended up in court, and it becomes a horrible mess. And you'd like to say, Michelle, that that is unusual. It's extreme, for sure, it is extreme. But it's actually not so unusual that things can't get quite unacceptable. I've had it myself in Oman, where in the end I just basically refused to ship the system until the EPC contractor had renewed and corrected the letter of credit for me to be paid, because if I'd have shipped the system, the letter of credit would not have been paid. And that's it. Then you're just sitting hoping that somebody's going to give you the money. In that case, the end user got involved and actually said to the EPC, we want this system on site. You must reissue the letter of credit. But you see how adversarial it can be by this stage if you're not extremely careful.
For sure.
And for me, again, if by this stage it's the relationship is not good, it's probably going to be very difficult to recover. The way I have seen contract management work extremely well, there has to already have been the start of a good relationship, but is where we effectively create a joint steering committee. And I've done this on several projects around the world, where the DCS vendor and the end user and or the EPC effectively create a steering committee to look at all these things and all the little problems and everything that can come up along the way. And the steering committee is empowered to basically make some kind of decision that can resolve any issues along the way. Then we now move forward into engineering and the actual engineering phase of the project itself. And I would have to say, in general, this seems to be an area where I see probably the least problems to the whole of the life cycle of a DCS. In general, once the engineers start work on the project, once they actually start doing the system, configuring the system, testing the system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, there can be, obviously, but there seems to be very few incidents of a bad relationship. If the relationship is good, the engineering stays good. If the relationship's even bad, the engineers themselves, when they're working between them, seem to be a different kind of animal. The thing seems to work quite well in general. And again, I come back to the Statoil example. They actually documented it at one stage. They produced a paper which showed the impact of the value that can be created the earlier major subcontractors, DCS very much included, are involved the earliest in the life cycle. And it was effectively a decreasing exponential. The earlier in the life cycle of a project that DCS vendor was involved and other major equipment vendors, the better it got, the more value they got out of it. Because the engineers knew each other, they worked together, they formed a relationship, they were having good ideas, the good ideas flowed, and everything seemed to go extremely well. Examples where problems can crop up, and I've seen them crop up, is again where you start to use, let's say, advanced technologies. And this is what we discussed a little bit last time, Michelle, the question of appropriate technology. There are all sorts of good things out there. Depending on what your circumstances are, those technologies can be very powerful, very good for you. But if you just take things without full knowledge of what it is that they're doing and why you want them and what value they can be to you, things can start to go wrong again. And that's probably one of the biggest areas I've ever seen of there being technical and engineering problems is in field bus projects. And in field bus projects, you really get to the point again where the DCS now goes right out into the field. It is the network cabling. It is all the drop boxes, the junction boxes, the power hubs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It even now becomes the field devices. And if it's not planned and done very carefully and everybody understands these things, that can become a very difficult process, even if you have very good engineering teams that are on very good terms. Things can get complicated. So again, I reiterate that the concept of appropriate technology and making sure everybody understands what it is they're trying to get from that technology, and those engineering groups are working together to achieve it and understand the full complexity of the layers and the features that are outside of a normal DCS functionality.
Could you talk at all about some of the problems that you saw with Fieldbus? Yeah, because I actually, absolutely, in my past company, we did a lot with Fieldbus, and I, you know, never really was aware of any issues, but I wasn't on the engineering side of it specifically.
Yeah. And again, I do it by examples. The first was in Belgium, I believe, if I remember correctly, and it was the largest chemical company in the world, or one of the largest chemical companies in the world, and they engineered the DCS, or the field bus control system. Everything went fine, good. Everybody accepted, these are the instrumentation we're going to use, this is the DCS, this is the configuration, etc., etc., etc. It all got to site. It was all installed. They pulled all the cables, laid all the segments, etc., etc., etc. And by the time they came to commission the plant, the field instruments weren't talking to the DCS anymore. Reason being, one of the field instrument providers, vendors, had changed the software, and they'd done something, and it was no longer compatible with the DCS, the version of software in the DCS. It became a very, very big problem, which actually led to that company at that point, shortly afterwards, saying, we will not use Fieldbus anymore. Finish. Stop.
So it adds a layer of complexity, because it's got its software, and that has to work properly with the DCS software. And if those things aren't working correctly, you can have problems, and it may not even notice right away that you've got the problems.
Correct. And the issue you get into with that one, Michelle, especially, is because you now basically have different vendors all supplying what is inherently now parts of the DCS. The field instruments become a part of the DCS, and they're coming from a totally different vendor. Interoperability is fine, and it's got better, but you could never fully rely on it. And we have several instances where I've had to take, especially valve positioners from one manufacturer, and we've had to take them back into our software center to look through the software. And there have been sort of small bugs in the foundation field bus, especially stacks, which have led to it just not working. But it's more than that as well, Michelle. You also have to remember now that all the cabling, the segments, it's no longer just running 2-core 4-20 milliamp cable where, you know, anybody can do it. You're just running cable and screwing in terminals, etc., etc. Now this has become a digital network. And so if I hope I don't cause offense here, the standard cable pulling installation contractor who's used to just pulling 4-20 dual core cables now is dealing with quite a sophisticated digital network. And if that network is not installed properly, tested properly, then the field instruments and the DCS are not going to communicate properly. There are going to be problems. Power is going down those networks to feed the instruments, and the whole thing can become quite difficult. And I have seen that on several occasions where the network, networking cabling and the installation of that cabling has led to massive problems in the operation of the system.
So there are benefits that you can get from Foundation Fieldbus with the additional information and control over the devices, but you need to make sure that for your operation that reward is worth the risk of the additional complexity and the additional cost to install.
Absolutely. And that you're going to use it. The time Foundation Fieldbus especially really came to prominence and really peaked in its use, I was in the Middle East. And the Middle East oil and gas companies, petrochemical companies, really went for Foundation Fieldbus one or two things. They either went for it in a big way or said no way. It was black and white. Some said we're not touching it. Others said it's mandatory, you have to have it. And the one thing I observed in several discussions, I said to people, why do you want to use this technology? Well, because it's modern and it's going to save us a fortune and it's but why? How? Do you actually understand what this is going to do for you? And I have to say, Michelle, in general, the answer was no, they didn't know. They really had no idea how it's going to do. Only one company at that stage, more have probably come on now, but only one company at that stage, Shell Petroleum, really, for me, had a vision of what it was going to do for them. And that was, it provided them with lots and lots of pertinent data that could be turned into information so they could run the plants more effectively and at lower cost. But that was the only company I really saw who had that vision and who understood that was what it was going to potentially do for you. Everybody else, Foundation Fieldbus, you can have control in the field devices. You can actually take the PID loops down out of the DCS controllers and put them in the field devices. And almost to a man, the customer's there, no way, you're not doing that. We're not doing that. So why do you want Foundation Fieldbus? Because that's actually one of its major features. No, we don't. We're not doing that. We keep the control. So why are you using this technology? And it all got around that. Yes, these technologies can have great benefits. But again, if you don't know why they have great benefits and you're not using them to obtain those benefits knowingly, then that's probably one of the issues that can then cause quite big problems during the engineering and commissioning phases of a project.
Yeah, I see.
And it can be very expensive to undo.
Yeah. So is it time for the best part?
The bit you're waiting for.
Service and life cycle support?
Yep. Okay. Woo! And again, I'm going to look at it a little bit from a commercial sense, I think, here. And we go back a little bit to the start of our discussion in session one, when we looked at the sort of typical costs involved here in a DCS project. And I'll just run through again, and these are crude numbers, sure, but they're not so far away, and they're average. And if, let's say, a 6,000 to 7,000 IO DCS system, fairly traditional type of structure, you're looking, I guess, around $1 million, something of that nature. Maybe it's changed a little bit since I retired, but it's in that kind of order. Now, that is the starting bit. And that's the bit that is very visible by the project engineering teams, by the procurement teams, by the guys that are building the plant. But one fascinating experience, absolutely fascinating, that I had, only ever with one company. It was genius, as far as I'm concerned. They said to us, when you bid for a project, we want two prices from you. We want the price for you to supply the engineered DCS system. Boom. $1 million, let's say. Then you have to give us a second price. And the second price is to guarantee that this system will remain serviceable for, they selected 15 years, maybe could be 20, whatever, 15 to 20 years. And let me just clarify what that means. It's not they want us to provide the price for all the spares and everything and it's all included in one lump sum day one. No. What they were saying was, we want you to give us the price that you guarantee that at no stage in the life cycle of this system, you will turn around to us and say, we cannot upgrade it because so many parts are obsolete. And fascinating, the price for that component was about similar to the initial price of the DCS.
So in your example, it'd be roughly maybe a million.
Exactly. Huh. And again, just to be very clear what that means, I buy a car. And what they're saying is, we know we still have to buy tyres and oil and so on and so forth. That's accepted. We'll buy those. But what you must confirm to us is you will never get to a stage where you say, yes, but these tyres no longer fit that car anymore. And we no longer make that size of tyre. So you can only buy this new size of tyre. And that means you've got to change the wheels and the engine and all the rest of it. The price you're giving us is guarantees that if you ever say the tyre size has changed and that's all that's now available, then you have guaranteed you will change the wheels for us.
So there was still the regular maintenance and spares, on top of this. Absolutely. But it was kind of an insurance policy that the vendor isn't going to really force them to do an upgrade.
It will never become exactly. It will never become obsolete. So effectively, what they were doing was asking us to guarantee Trigger's Broom that it could always be done.
Yeah. Huh. That's an interesting concept.
It was mind bending. The company I was working for at the time, the guys in there, the commercial guys, the service guys, went crazy. They said, hey, we can't quote this. There's no way. They're mad. We can't do it. But, of course, then the further we discussed it, the more it became understood what it was they were asking for. And, Michelle, this requirement actually came as a result of that project in Belgium. When, by the time the system had got to commissioning, the field instruments weren't talking to the system anymore. They were guaranteeing that no matter what happened during the 20 years, the system was always serviceable. It could always be made to operate. It could be upgraded, whatever it took to operate. And we had to give them a guaranteed price at day zero of what it would take to guarantee that. And then what they did, they selected the vendor based on the sum of the DCS itself and that guarantee component. So if you, for example, said, well, okay, I want this job, so the DCS price is $1 million and I'll just say $500,000 for this guarantee, you may well get the quote, the contract on that. But then you had to make, you were committed then for 15, 20 years. You had to make sure that system was always serviceable.
The vendors lost their minds trying to come up with those numbers.
I developed some Excel spreadsheets and I did it. And I was in China at the time when I did it. And actually, you know what? It was actually quite easy. Once you sat and understood what it was they were asking, it was quite easy. And I personally thought it was very good. It really was a nice solution. It really did well. And yeah. I have to say, I know the million, the one-to-one's about right, because we never lost a job. So I know that the figures we were given were pretty reasonable.
Oh, that's good info.
And then on top of that, then... Okay, so what does that guarantees basically that the thing is serviceable. It remains serviceable throughout its life. You've never got to rip and replace the complete DCS with all the havoc and the chaos and the downtime that causes. But then, of course, you also have to say then, well, now I still have to buy my spares. You know, that didn't cover, okay, an IO card's blown up, or you have to change this, or you have to do a software update or whatever, etc., etc., etc. So in terms of that 1 million now plus 1 million, in my experience, it depends a little bit one way or the other. But if you remember that graph we did in our project, Michelle, you're probably looking at somewhere around 500,000, possibly 750,000 over the 20-year life cycle of a DCS for spares, checks, diagnostics, training, etc., etc., and all the other service facilities that you need to keep that DCS running throughout its life.
So for some reason, I had a benchmark of around 10% per year of the original capital expense for services, but maybe I'm misremembering that. So would you say it's maybe about 5% per year expected on maintenance costs?
It does vary a great deal, I have to say. And these are highly average numbers, Michelle, so take them with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But yeah, I mean, for me, and then of course, I don't think I've seen many plants where there haven't been some kind of additions. Or we want to add a couple of valves over there, and we want to add a little bit over here and add something over there. So there's always expansions, a few expansions. And over 20 years, you know, a few of those also adds up. And in my estimation, you really are looking, when you take a 1 million DCS capex value on, you really are looking at a 20-year expenditure of between 2.5, possibly up to 3 million. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Without the helicopter view, it's very difficult to see and understand. And the people generally that are in individual phases of the project don't get to see the other phases. And that's really the point of this whole session that we're having, Michelle, is to put that part. It is a living, breathing system that has to be maintained for the full useful life. And that escalates that original 1 million purchase price considerably.
Yeah, and it's an important consideration to have, right? Because a lot of the times the people that are involved with the upfront negotiation of the capital portion of the project are not the people who are going to necessarily live with it for the next 10, 20 years. And sometimes the serviceability or the, you know, life cycle cost is kind of lost in that shuffle, where people will expect, you know, okay, I've bought it, now I'm done. And they don't understand that there's this, you know, maintenance aspect that needs to continue on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I loved being in China. I loved living there. The customers were great and everything. But I always used to say, in China, the attitude was, we buy a DCS, it comes with a 25-year no quibble guarantee. We pay for nothing more. Everything for the next 25 years was in that original price. Well, no, sorry, guys, that's not how it works. It's not how it works. And if we go back, you remember we looked a little bit at the percentage of the total capex of a plant that the DCS is, somewhere between 0.25% and 0.5% typically. If you now take that $1 million initial price of the DCS and say, well, actually, you know what, over the life cycle, that's probably going to be nearer 2.5, something like that, then that percent of the total plant capex is still very, very small. It's still well under 1%.
Mm-hmm.
But it is it's the heart of it. It's what makes or breaks the plant and the performance of that plant. And if that DCS stops, either because it wasn't engineered properly to start with, or because you cut so many corners, or because you're not servicing it properly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the plant will stop. And you and I think, had a number for a typical plant outage of, was it $250,000 an hour in some cases, something like that. So this guy is key to the plant operation. And at the end of the day, the capex, it's a relatively small nibble at the total plant capex, but it's so emotional, it tends to get penny pinch, and that's where, in my opinion and my experience, things mainly go wrong if you're not careful.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, we are going to have to wrap up. So, is there anything that you want to leave with our listeners as the conclusion to this whole discussion? You know, what should they take away from it?
The final question, if you remember, was, if I had a plant and I was buying a DCS, what, from the experience I've had, what would I do?
Right.
How would I approach it? So let's maybe now just to go through those. So for the vendor list, again, the finer detail depends a little bit on the what plant it is and everything. But I would definitely go with some kind of restricted vendor list. And that restricted vendor list would be decided in some kind of benchmarking exercise to make sure the product I'm looking at absolutely is what I like, what I want, and does for me. And I would merge that with some kind of frame agreement. So the costs of the initial purchase and the life cycle in some way are tied up to some frame agreement that's established between us. The specification, very, very clear for me, as simple as possible and as functional as possible. Make it more bespoke than just a generic copy, and really think about the technology, appropriate technology only. If there's something good that can really do something for you, go with it, but understand it beforehand and buy it because you know it's going to give you value. For tendering, I would eliminate tendering. For me, it's one of the biggest danger areas in the whole process. I would, because it's a restricted vendor list, I would basically make a decision on the vendor and then aim to work with them from as early as possible in the project. And I would do it on a time and material basis within a frame agreement situation. The negotiation phase, I'd eliminate it. I just wouldn't do it. But I would replace it with a value engineering, which actually would not then be maybe a distinct step, but which would be spread across the earlier stages. So always the customer, the end user, and the DCS vendor are looking to create a good high value solution rather than just an initial low price solution that turns into a very high price. The contract management, I'd have a joint team. A joint steering committee, a joint team from comprising vendors and end user and EPC members, if you like, that basically are charged with deciding on any contractual situation that arises during the thing and not resorting to any aggressive type of application. The engineering, again, absolutely clear. Statoil did this so beautifully. Vendor involved as early as possible. Bring them in, start working together as early as possible. That is how you get the best value from the system you're buying. Life cycle cost, I would definitely go with that serviceability contract. I would make the DCS vendor basically give a guarantee, and they don't just give it for free. You would have to have a price on it, and it becomes a buyable. But a serviceability contract which says you are responsible for guaranteeing this system is still capable of working, not working, but capable of working in 20, 25 years time, whatever your desire for the plant longevity is. And I would establish a long-term rolling service contract with a agreed appropriate contract, not just every year we'll sign a new contract and the price goes. I would sit and I would actually agree, even at the early stages, the concept of a service agreement. Mm-hmm. And the objective would be this triggers broom. Yeah, I want it. Once I go with a vendor, and I've seen this, I've been involved in projects that have this, where the DCS is on site for 30 plus years. None of the components are the same at the end of the 30 years, but the relationship has been there, and always it's been upgrading to keep that system working at the forefront of technology and with minimum impact to production. And extensions and expansions, again, by the frame agreement. BASF Germany did this beautifully. There were frame agreements that defined the cost of all the components of DCS, so that even when it was an extension, we want to add a controller over there, add some IO cards, add this, add that, it's all predefined under a frame agreement. There's no bid it, give me prices, argue, discount, blah, blah, blah. It's all defined. everything's done up front. And then our favourite subject, which we'll, I guess, sign out on, is the future and what would be the future of DCS. Mm. And for 20 years plus, I am absolutely sure one day somebody is going to do a full lease. I ask myself every time, why does a customer buy a DCS? Why?
Mm.
Why not lease it?
Yeah, which we've talked about quite a bit.
Absolutely. With full life responsibility.
Yeah, so I would love to do maybe a separate session on that. Plus, I know we've got other topics in the works that you and I have talked about doing separate sessions on. So there will be more to come from Paul. I'm impressed. I did not think you could wrap that up in 5 minutes, and you did. That was a great wrap up.
I could have gone on and on and on.
But thank you so much for your time. This has been really amazing examples from your real life experience. And I think that's the best to learn from, right, is real life experience. So thank you for sharing that with us. And I can't wait to have you on again.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Have a great day.
And you.
Thanks, everyone, for joining me for today's episode of Interactive Control, where we discuss the different phases of a typical DCS lifecycle, including Paul's recommended best practices for each phase. We at Nexus Controls hope you found this discussion helpful. If so, please subscribe to our podcast and tell all your control friends about us. And don't forget to check out part one of this discussion if you missed it. You may also want to check out our website at nexuscontrols.com. where you can learn more about our products and services. Lastly, don't forget the title of this podcast is Interactive Control for a reason. If you have a topic you'd like us to cover that we haven't yet, or if you'd be interested in being a guest on our show, please send me a message over LinkedIn or email, and we'll do our best to cover it in a future episode. Thanks again, and bye for now.